The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
A veteran of the Spartacus League, a colleague of Luxembourg, who went through the events in the 1920s, later joined the left opposition, went through the camps under Hitler and also under Stalin, and finally I came to know him. And so I talked to him about these events, and I'm not going to try to present the events around Levy's leaving the party as he saw it. Now, it's my words, but I think it's consistent with his outlook. So, here I am, the Berlin worker. You can just call me the Berliner. In October 1921, we finally achieved unity with the majority of the centrist independent social democrats. Our party now had 350,000 members, four times more than before that fusion. Our fusion convention resolved that we were now strong enough to undertake confrontational actions on our own as a party. Much to my shock, just after that fusion, Paul Levy and his team published what they called an open letter offering to join in struggle with the hated Social Democrats around limited immediate demands. Needless to say, the Social Democrats turned this down, and our campaign for the open letter, it did lead to some gains in the union, but it did not lead to revolution. It was a far cry from the socialist revolution I felt was possible at that time. But life is full of surprises. A month later, Levy and his team were chucked out of the leadership. It seems he had supported an Italian socialist called Cerati, a discredited centrist, and had been on Cerati's side in a split in the Italian section. And that's why he left the leadership. But the real issue was the fact that he was habitually passive and excessively cautious in not leading the party forward into the actions that were necessary and possible. These events with Levy and Cerati showed that it was time to make a clean sweep of the right wing of our movement in Germany, in Italy, in France, and in Czechoslovakia. Well, after Levy left, the new crew stepped up our calls for confrontational action. They were hoping the tensions between Germany and the victor powers of the First World War would explode, creating a situation where we could overthrow the government. Our papers started calling on the workers to pick up the gun. Well, the international tensions did not explode. Something else happened. The Social Democratic government marched police into an area where we were strong, hoping to lure us into a premature showdown. I find it hard to understand what happened next. But a protest strike spread through that region. And then suddenly, forces outside our party launched a guerrilla war and swept up a lot of radical workers in that. Police reinforcements arrived with machine guns and artillery, and resistance was drowned in blood. Our party had to respond. It called a general strike for the overthrow of the government. That was what became known as our March Action. Here in Berlin, the strike was a fiasco. Across the country, it did not even mobilize our members, let alone the working class as a whole. And in trying to organize the strike, we fought pitched battles with non-communist workers. Paul Levy published a pamphlet denouncing our strike. He was immediately expelled. Meanwhile, our leadership said our action was a great success and had now to be followed up by more such actions. They carried the idea into our World Congress of the Communist International, calling it the, quote, theory of the offensive. That is, we should always be on the offensive. Yet, even as they got on the train to Moscow, something quite strange was happening back in Germany. The party resumed united initiatives copied from Levy's open letter. And as for the World Congress in Moscow, well, I tell you, that one was hard to figure out. Levy's expulsion was endorsed, but Levy's cautious approach seemed to win general support. The Congress issued a call to the masses and set the goal of winning majority support in the working class before making a bid for power. Well, you can understand we in Berlin were pretty sour about that. Later on, that notion of to the masses became known as the United Front policy. And in the end, I came to support it, and so did a lot of my comrades in Berlin. But we carried it forward, perhaps Levy's ideas, but without Paul Levy. That's the end of my channeling experiment for the day. So we now come back from Germany in 1921 to Chicago. And I'm going to say what I think about this story. As a Marxist leader, Levy was exceptionally talented. But there was a one-sidedness in his personal abilities. His achievements in building the German Communist Party were made possible by the strength and cohesion of the team around him, which was also the team that had worked with Rosa Luxemburg in building the Spartacus League during the war. It was a difficult situation because the top leaders, Rosa Luxemburg and others, had all been murdered in 1919. But Levy and his comrades, pulling together, were able to lead the party successfully and take it forward. In 1920, that team shattered, leaving Levy exposed and fatally undermining his position as a central leader. Why did that happen? The decisive factor in this story was a debate on revolutionary strategy in Germany, rooted in the experience of the workers there in 1919, a time when capitalism in Germany seemed near collapse. The initial outlook of revolutionary socialists in Europe in 1919 was summarized 3 years later by, 2 years later, by Leon Trotsky. When the Comintern was formed, it was hoped that workers' chaotic, spontaneous assault would mount in ever-rising waves, and that in this way, the proletariat would attain state power in the course of 1 or 2 years. But in Germany, by mid-1919, the first attempts to achieve workers' power had been crushed at great cost in workers' lives, and the capitalist class had regained the upper hand. What to do? Workers responded in two ways. The majority became quite cautious. Having been brutally attacked by the police and the army, they didn't want to risk it again unless it seemed that the chances were good. They clung to social democracy as their best defense. Meanwhile, a radical minority, not one of a few dozen, but of hundreds of thousands, rallied to the Communist Party, hoping the party could relaunch the offensive against capitalism. In these conditions, Levy was indeed a voice of caution. He warned against a premature showdown with the capitalist rulers at a time when revolutionary-minded workers, although numbering in the hundreds of thousands, were still a small minority in the class. He pressed communists to take initiatives that were inclusive, aimed at restoring unity in action by the working class as a whole. This was not a new idea. It was rooted in the Bolshevik experience in Russia. But remarkably, it was Paul Levy who popularized this idea in the Communist International at that time. Levy first argued this view in June 1919, shortly after the Communists and Social Democrats formed a revolutionary coalition government in Hungary, led by Béla Kun, of whom Paul will be speaking in a couple of minutes. The new regime, which declared itself a dictatorship of the proletariat, began to expropriate bourgeois property. But victory had not come to the workers through struggle, Levy pointed out. It had been handed to the communists by the collapse of bourgeois rule. He warned that taking power on this basis would lead to disastrous defeat, which of course it did a couple months later. Levy cited here the founding principle of the German Communist Party, namely that it, and I quote, will never take governmental power except through the clear and unambiguous will of the great majority of proletarian masses in Germany, through their conscious agreement with the communists' outlook, goals, and methods of struggle. When bourgeois power collapsed in Hungary, Levy argued, the communists would have done better to organize the proletariat through councils, and then in these councils to win the workers to the project of forming a workers' government and then carrying it out together with them. The Hungarian revolutionary, government survived only 3 months before being crushed by the invading armies of the surrounding powers, and it was replaced by a brutal dictatorship. Lévy's position on Hungary did not gain much support in the Communist International. Many argued that the Hungarian revolutionary government was, if you will, a good try, that it could have won out if the revolution had matured faster elsewhere. Karl Radek, the Comintern leader responsible for its relations with the German party, wrote that the existence of the Hungarian revolutionary government, even if brief, aided the Russian Soviet Republic at the height of the Civil War. Okay, the next item I want to mention came 6 months later, 4 months later, in the fall of 1919, when the German party split. And it split, if you will, between those who agreed with Lévy's general approach and those who were more impatient and wanted action right away. That's an oversimplification, but that was the main issue. The discussion, I should say that the, let me continue. The discussion was renewed with regard to a workers' uprising in March 1920 that overthrew a short-lived military coup, the so-called Kapp-Putsch in Germany. A mighty general strike against the coup swept the coup away. It was a strike called by the social democratic leaders of the unions and then carried out by all the workers together. The coup quickly collapsed, but the strike continued as workers demanded decisive measures against future rightist threats. Desperate to get the workers back on the job, the union leadership called for an all-socialist government formed of the workers' parties and the unions. The German Communist Party countered by saying it would not take part in such a government, but would act towards it as a loyal opposition, provided that the regime took serious measures against the rightists. The statement aimed to link up the workers' conviction that that it was their unity that had defeated the putsch, to link up that consciousness of unity with the communist perspective for revolution. The all-socialist government did not come into being, and the communists divided over whether the German party's response had been correct. Now, Lévy did not write that statement. He was in jail at the time, but he gave it qualified support. However, the statement came under very strong attack from other leaders in the German party and in the international. Radek said that the statement's authors had renounced their historic mission as revolutionary leaders, as strong words indeed. Moreover, Radek claimed that the party's opposition to putschism had led to passivity, to a refusal to act over the whole preceding year, a kind of quietism, he said. Quietism is a sort of like the Quakers, a German version of that in the religious field. Well, this turned the criticism against Lévy himself and his overall record as a party leader. Now, Béla Kun went further, arguing that the idea of unity itself in the struggle was wrong, that the fact that workers had joined together across party lines had been a weakness, not a strength, and that the united front of the workers was a reactionary illusion. This view also had support in the German party. The Comintern discussion that followed was complex and inconclusive, a half-opened debate, as Pierre Brouet called it, and you'll get an excellent account of it in this book, The German Revolution by Brouet. With regard to Paul Lévy's role, 4 points are important. The leadership team built by the Rosa Luxemburg divided right down the middle, some with Lévy, some against him. The Comintern leadership divided as well. Radek, Zinoviev, and others with the leftist opposition, Lenin writing more in accord with Lévy's approach. The subsequent World Congress of the Communist International in the summer of 1920 did not discuss the Kapp experience, but it did provide an occasion for Radek and some of his colleagues to form a sort of bloc with the left opposition in Germany. The partisan intervention of the communist leaders in the German dispute, and this is something perhaps Jen will be talking on, made it impossible for the German leadership to restore its unity through its own experiences. Increasingly, eyes turned to Moscow for guidance. Now, during the year after the Kapp Putsch, the capitalist state continued to consolidate and repression grew stronger. Workers were, in Clara Zetkin's words, almost desperate yet unwilling to struggle. Meanwhile, a significant layer of revolutionary-minded workers, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, were moving to the left, inspired by the victories of the Soviet government and increasing in impatience and determination. Lenin said of this period, "Discontented, suffering workers feel revolutionary but are politically raw and confused. World history does not seem to hurry, but they think that their own party leaders don't want it to hurry." So the impatience turns inward into the party. The mood of impatience gained increasing influence in the Communist Party as the months passed. I mentioned four items. One is, after the Kapp Putsch, an ultra-left party consolidated to the left of the Communist Party with about 50,000 members, well-rooted in the factories, experienced, and a considerable pressure on the communist movement. By the way, this ultra-left party was recognized by the Communist International as a fraternal party, which the Communist Party strongly objected to. Second, the Communist Party leadership often sought to restrain its trade union forces from launching isolated struggles likely to lead to costly defeats. That policy was resented by many in the membership. Third, the Communist Party late in 1920 fused with about 350,000 members from a centrist formation, USPD. These new members tended to be short on Marxist education and long on impatience. In January 1921, when they adopted a version of the United Front policy that they called the Open Letter, this policy did not bring any dramatic victories. It was effective, but only over time. And so the policy clashed with the belief of many members that bold action could bring workers' power in the coming months. As you heard a few minutes ago, in February 1921, the ultra-lefts won a majority in the German Communist Party leadership with a good deal of encouragement from representatives from Moscow. The stimulus came from a split in Italy. But even without that development, ultra-left pressures were increasing in the ranks of the German party. In the following month, the German ultra-lefts launched an insurrectional general strike, the disastrous March action, which launched the communists into a confrontation not only with the state, but with the working class majority. Jen and Paul will have more to say about that. The destructive role of the Moscow-based leaders in this drama needs an explanation. I see no evidence that they reflected ultra-left pressures from Russia, from the Russian Communist Party. They seem rather to have been adapting with a good deal of vacillation and uncertainty to the moods of impatient radical leaders in Central Europe. To impatient radical workers in Central Europe. Indeed, members of the Moscow communist leadership directly involved in the German and Italian events came not from Russia, but from Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, and Germany, that is, out of the very milieu where these pressures were strongest. They were disoriented by the fact that a broad and impatient vanguard lair, made up of the best revolutionary forces in these countries, was headed in a different direction from the mass of the workers. What was needed at that time was a united and authoritative leadership in Germany that could have persuaded that vanguard of the need to unity, for unity, and the need to slow down their pace somewhat in order to achieve that unity, and the need to be on the lookout for provocations by the ruling class aimed at cutting them up and defeating them one sector at a time. The Bolsheviks carried out that task successfully in Russia in 1917. The team built by Rosa Luxemburg, however, was shattered by that challenge. And once the team was broken, Paul Levy's position was untenable, and his exit from the leadership was only a matter of time. And so we are left with the ideas of Paul Levy and Zetkin and Lenin and Trotsky and the other central strategists of the communist revolution at that period. It has an interesting resonance in our time, because although the problem of unity with social democrats is not posed in this way in the United States, I mean, we have the Democratic Party, which is another kettle of fish entirely, the problem of trying to unite the forces of the working class is posed every time you get involved in a serious action. And the problem of winning a majority on specific issues is definitely one that we grapple with and occasionally win. Thank you.
Thanks, John, for introducing this for us. It's true that let's look at the two words about the March Action and then two words about the Comintern's role in this. The March Action was a catastrophe on a scale that is really hard to imagine. That party of 350,000 that John talked about was shattered. And I don't think it ever recovered. I think that what recovered was a shell of its former self. Something like 200,000 people left the party. Tens of thousands lost their jobs. People just were fired from their jobs. There were several who were condemned to death. People were sent to prison. It was an enormous... This is not ultra-leftism that leads to, like, oh, oops, you know, I lost $20 or something. This was a catastrophe. And it left the party completely vulnerable to the Stalinization that followed from that. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very vulnerable thing. It was a real catastrophe. We have to actually sort of try to embrace the scale of this thing. We've never seen anything like this. We have never seen a party of 350,000 try to, on its own, challenge for state power in a country of 50 million people. I mean, this is quite a big thing to do. If people remember the night, it's like the Tupamaros in Uruguay, but massively, you know, 40 times more in terms of size and more important in terms of their place in power. And I remember when the Tupamaros threw their bodies against the guns of the right wing, and it was a horrible, horrible thing to see. Okay, number one. Number two, it is true that the Communist International representatives who played a terrible role, Bela Kun, I'm going to speak about here, were not Russian. They were not Russian, but they were sent there by Russians. They were sent there by the Comintern. The Comintern leadership gave them that job, and they shouldn't have. And I don't buy the argument that I've heard that it's because there was a labor shortage and they just took whoever was around, and because Bela Kun spoke Russian, they sent him. It's not good enough. It's not good enough. I think that we have to actually really soberly look at this and try to draw some lessons from it. There's a lovely little article that John mentioned in this book, translated in the Steps of Rosa Luxemburg by Paul Levy about Bela Kun in the Hungarian Revolution 1920. And I'm going to try to amplify some of the points in that book points in Levy's article to try to make some points about this period. I think that what's at stake is big, that Paul Levy, in essence, represented the politics of self-emancipation. The quote that John gave is a beautiful quote. Rosa Luxemburg wrote it December 1918. What does the Spartacist League want? The Spartacist League will never take over governmental power except in response to the clear, unambiguous will of the great majority of the proletarian mass of all of Germany. This is the key. This is the essence. We will not take power unless there is a majority in the Soviets, if you want to put it in Russian terms, versus substitutionism. The politics of substitutionism is saying that there might be another road. We might be able to take power through a smaller party or without majority support or with an army, which was later to be tried in different places. And the politics of substitutionism was represented very, very clearly by the March Action and by Bela Kun. I will also suggest, I think, that this problem of substitutionism is not a psychological one. It's not a psychological one of Bela Kun and Zinoviev and other individuals, although they did have some psychological issues, I think. But it's rooted, there's two things about it, I think we need to talk about. I think there is an aspect of the Bolshevik experience that is substitutionist, that we tend not to look at. Mm-hmm. There is an we emphasize the self-emancipationist side of the Bolshevik experience, which is real. All part of the Soviets, that's the self-emancipationist side of it. But there was also a thread that is substitutionist, number one. Number two, that this is not reducible to the problem of politics and personalities. It's built into the situation the Bolsheviks are facing. The Bolsheviks are fighting two revolutions. They're fighting the self-emancipationist revolution, the working class revolution. They were also fighting a bourgeois revolution. And the bourgeois revolution is a substitutionist exercise, ultimately. It involves mass organization, but ultimately it's a minority who takes the lead of it. And that affected their politics, and sometimes they got the mix wrong. And they got the mix wrong very big time in Germany. Okay, so what was the experience that Bela Kun brought to Russia and was brought to Germany, promoted into that position in Germany by the Comintern? The experience of Hungary was the following. There was a real revolution in Hungary in 1918, 1919, and we should look at it. It's a wonderful moment, actually. It's a horrible moment. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was taken into war. 8 million people conscripted in the Austro-Hungarian army war in the World War I, 90% casualties. Like 3.6 million people injured, 1.2 million people killed, a couple million people in prison camps. Is a horrible experience, and this created a revolutionary circumstance. There was and it was sparked by Russia. With the February Revolution, you could see the possibility of the end. Say, okay, we can overthrow czars, so we can overthrow aristocracies. With the October Revolution, or November, depending on which calendar you use, and the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, they said the war's over. Suddenly, the war on the Eastern Front ends, and they say, okay, that's it. Now we can do something. And so the internationalism, this is beautiful. The Russian Revolution directly inspires the workers of Hungary, and there is, by October 1918, real power in Budapest, at least. The main city in Hungary is in the hands of the workers' and soldiers' councils. Now, and the second point made by Levy in this article, he says, good, power is in the hands of the Workers' Council in October 1918, but this will not be an easy road to the dictatorship of the proletariat. You do not get the dictatorship of the proletariat when workers inherit power as a result of the collapse of the bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. Workers' power is not about the bourgeoisie collapsing, it's about the working class rising. Mm-hmm. And the working class in Austro-Hungary was only beginning the process of rising, the beginning of the process of being able to, as far as we are concerned, this is Levy's words, the possibility for the dictatorship of the proletariat exists not when the bourgeoisie collapses, but when the proletariat rises, goes on though. This is the context in which Bela Kun emerges. Bela Kun's an interesting man. He was a journalist for a social democratic newspaper in Hungary before World War I, conscripted into the army, in prison very quickly thereafter, in prison in Russia. The story of the Hungarian prisoners in Russia, there were 500,000 Hungarians ended up in prisoner of war camps in Russia. 20% of them ended up joining the Red Army. You know, 100,000, it's a beautiful, sort of beautiful story. It was a mass base for recruiting people, and that's where the core of the Hungarian communists came from, Bela Kun amongst them. And Kun and hundreds of others of them were sent to Hungary to participate in the revolutionary process there. So Kun went to Hungary with hundreds of new members, and he went with a whole lot of money as well. Two things hand in hand. And his entire method from that point on was one of unending search for substitutions to the workers' councils. Unending search for substitutions. Instead of a sustained, and contrast it, okay, it begins with the fact that the communists are minority in the workers' councils movement. Well, this happens. February Revolution, the Bolsheviks are minority inside the workers' councils in St. Petersburg. That minority status comes back in a horrifying way. Think of July days in 1917. Think of the massive repression that's unleashed on the Bolsheviks in 1917. Now, what's Lenin's response in 1917 in the context of being a minority inside the working class, the real reaction setting in? Instructions to the party are patiently explained. Patiently explained, says, every one of you knows 10 other workers. Your job is to go and talk to 10 people you work with and explain who the Bolsheviks are and what our program is. You do that, we'll turn the situation around. It's a political response. It's a response that looks at what's the political, and it's a self-active response. What's the activity that the Bolshevik members can do to turn the situation around? What's Bela Kun's response? He looks for ways around it. He gets, the communists get leadership of a mass youth organization, the Young Workers League, but they don't do it through political persuasion. They do it by saying, we can actually give you a newspaper and we can hire a lot of organizers. It's actually not a good method. It does the same thing with a couple of trade unions. Now, that's What I've given you is a caricature. I've only got a few minutes. Amongst the unemployed and the soldiers, there was real influence for the communists. That was where they had the real base. They had a real base amongst the mass unemployed from the collapse of the thing. But inside the working class in the employed factories was resolutely social democratic in terms of its political loyalties. So in November 1918, for instance, out of 365 delegates to the Budapest Workers' Council, seven were members of the Communist Party. Okay. But instead of patiently explain, that's Lenin's approach. The reproach is to denounce the Workers' Council as a tool of the reformists. So you separate yourself from the Workers' Council experience, saying you're a tool of the reformists. Also, there is a confusing and very hard to figure out moment where there is a demonstrations by the unemployed outside. They attack the social democratic newspapers. The communists participate. Them seven people are killed. Kuhn is arrested. All the rest of it. Kuhn's arrested. That provokes the radicalization inside the working class towards the communists. The working class looks at the repression being brought down upon the communists from Bela Kuhn by the Social Democratic Party in office, and they start to have more and more sympathy for the communists. The situation starts to collapse. Leader of the Social Democrats comes into the prison cell where Kuhn is and says, "Let's do a deal." And there's a diplomatic negotiations happen inside the prison cell, and they come up with a deal. The deal is the two parties are going to fuse. The Communist Party is going to fuse the Social Democratic Party, and that will be the new government. It's taken to the Workers' Council. The Workers' Council says, "We agree with this," and declare the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is not going to work. This is the ultimate in substitutionism. To think that you can have dictatorship of the proletariat on the basis of diplomatic negotiations that happen behind the scenes in a prison cell, which is clearly, in retrospect, a maneuver by the left wing of the Social Democrats to get themselves out of an appalling situation, and their role is terrible in all this. In office, there's real ultra-leftism, the ultra-left politics. I mean, there's nothing like what the Bolsheviks do. They expropriate everything. I mean, Lenin nationalizes the industries only reluctantly after the capitalists go on strike. Kuhn and the communists nationalize on principle. Things have to be, private property is, etc. In the countryside, they have a terrible policy. They don't give land to the peasants. They alienate, I won't go into the details, they massively alienate the peasantry, opposite of what the Bolsheviks did in Russia, leading to the peasants withdrawing food, no food to the cities, therefore the workers can't eat, therefore the workers can't work in the factories. The situation falls apart. The only response in this moment is Bela Kuhn increasingly turns to terror as the only way of running the situation until the communists have almost no support. The communists lose almost all support and leave on a train into exile after 3 months in office. That's a 7-minute summary of Bela Kuhn's political training and his savvy. Contrast that with what Levy was saying about self-emancipation. Contrast that with the experience that John talked about in terms of the sensitive approach to the need to build unity and mass action and all the rest of it. Now ask yourself a question in terms of if I left it just here, we would just leave saying, what a silly man Bela Kuhn is. But he gets a promotion. Levy gets expelled. Bela Kuhn gets promoted. Levy gets expelled for telling the truth. Unserweg, our road against putschism, is a brilliant pamphlet. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely correct. He gets expelled for it. Bela Kuhn leads thousands into catastrophe in Hungary, gets a promotion, and never gets expelled from the party. He eventually gets killed by Stalin, actually, in 1938. But then everyone gets killed by Stalin in 1938. It's a horrible thing. But, I mean, seriously, more communists killed by Stalin than by anyone else. But he gets coddled. Bela Kuhn is criticized from time to time. In the Fourth Congress, I was reading John's translation of the Fourth Congress, he's part of the celebration of the fifth anniversary. The first speaker is Clara Zetkin, the third speaker is Bela Kuhn. Zetkin and Bela Kuhn, right after the other. Levy, by contrast, is undermined, treated with contempt, and ignored. In Moscow, when Levy goes to Moscow at one point, he sees on Zinoviev's desks letters being sent to all the middle-level cadre of the party. He says, "What are you trying to do? Undermine me? I'm the leadership of this party. What are you doing?" It speaks badly to the way in which the Comintern identified what was necessary in Germany in 19, 20 and 21. How do we evaluate this? Ian Burchell, my friend Ian Burchell, says that Paul Levy should be scolded for scabbing on the party, that when you publish, because this pamphlet against putschism was published outside the party press. I think Burchell's completely wrong. I don't think there's any crime, quote-unquote, in publishing outside the party press. Lenin loved to threaten to do this all the time, and if Lenin has the right to do it, then others do as well, etc. More importantly than this, though, so that's one question to ask. Why was Kuhn given this responsibility, and why the difference in attitude, the massive, massive belittling and undermining of Paul Levy and the coddling of Bella Kuhn, even when everyone knew that what he had done was a catastrophe? More important was this, that this was not just the March action, it was codified as the theory of the offensive. Mm-hmm. On the theory of the offensive, Tukhachevsky added to this theory of the offensive by saying that it was also Tukhachevsky, the great general of the Civil War period, etc., saying that it was not just a crass struggle issue, but a military issue. Revolution could be spread at the point of the bayonet. I don't have, and read Isaac Deutsch's biography of Trotsky. He says that in 1920, Trotsky's magnificent obsession was to combat this theory, saying this theory of the offensive is absolutely wrong. It's gonna break us. So there's an argument against Bella Kuhn, it's an argument against the ultra-lefts in the German party, it's an argument against that. It's also an argument against Lenin. Because the theory of the offensive was not just applied in March in 1921, it was applied in Poland in 1920, when, as the last act, or one of the last acts of the Civil War, the Russian army invaded Poland, which is like the British army invading Ireland or the Canadian army invading Quebec. The notion that Russian and Lenin's, we now know from a secret speech that's just been translated, he said, we wanted to probe with bayonets to see if the Poles and the Russians are ready for revolution. This will not work. And this was Lenin, after the fact, agreed that it was wrong, but it was a mistake that actually cost 200,000 lives and was a catastrophe, and I'll wrap up on this. Okay. I think this is substitutionism. I think that the invasion of Poland is substitutionism. I think that Bella Kuhn's clearly what happened in Hungary is substitution. I think this is what Levy's politics were combating, and it's a tension that exists in the heart of the left in the post-1917 period. Lenin saw this. His book, Left Wing Communism, is one of the best critiques of substitution that's ever been written. It's really excellent in many ways. But interestingly, he published that before the invasion of Poland. So Lenin was only half right. He was writing this thing, but he didn't, in that instance, take it to himself. The ambivalence, is, as I said, is not psychological. It has material roots. There are two revolutions in Russia which have tensions. It's hard to combine them. The Bolsheviks did a brilliant job of combining them, but we must not mix up the substitutionist methods that are characteristic of a bourgeois revolution with the self-emancipation methods that without which we cannot have a working-class revolution. We need greater attention on the self-emancipation side of our tradition. That's Levy, Trotsky, Zetkin, Luxembourg, and not shy away from harsh criticisms of the dead end of substitutionism, even when that takes us to a criticism of the Comintern and of comrades like Lenin. I'll leave it at that. Whoops.
Sorry.
Okay.
Generous.
Okay. Wow. Can you move this one? Sorry, I have quotes on this computer that I didn't print out.
Uh-oh.
Sorry. No. Few quotes.
But no, the quote, I'm worried about the water in the computer. I'm a computer fan.
Okay, Paul's raised a bunch of questions that I'm not going to be able to address. I was going to address this from a slightly different starting point, but I did want to just say one thing about the question of substitutionism to bring into the discussion, which is that I think that there's a difference between adopting a series of substitutionist policies or actions or looking for shortcuts in a context of, you know, world revolutionary period or things like that, and an abandonment of the politics of self-emancipation. And I think that obviously then there's a slippery slope, because I think that there's a question of when does the quantitative become qualitative, and I think that that's the question that a lot of us grapple with when we look back at the rise of Stalinism, the Comintern, all of those kinds of questions. But when I look at the leftists in Germany and some of the experience at the Second Congress, Third Congress, Fourth Congress, what I'm seeing at that point is not a tendency to abandon self-emancipation, but a real question of how do we begin to break out of this impasse? And there's a number of questions that arise from that, but I think that's worth us discussing in the discussion. But I actually wanted to start from somewhat of a different point, and some questions that I think are very relevant, at least for me and hopefully for other people, in terms of the question of building political organization today. Because it seems to me undoubtedly true, like reading the collection of Levy's writings, that he was one of the most clear-sighted leaders, if not the most clear-sighted leader, of the German party following Rosa Luxemburg's death. And I agree with a lot of the assessment of his article on Putschism, like his article on the March action. It was clear that he had an incredibly incisive critique, and as well as obviously the development of the open letter, United Front policy, et cetera, et cetera. So then I think the question becomes, why wasn't he able to win the party to that? And why wasn't he able to lead around that? And how did he find himself so quickly outside of the party? And is that simply a matter of intervention from Moscow or intervention from the ECCI? Or is there something both in terms of the actions that Levy and his collaborators took, as well as the political moment itself and some of the challenges they were facing. And so I think that question of what do you do when you find yourself in a minority in your own party and you're convinced you're right, how do you begin to move forward? How do you begin to argue that? And just to say, when we're talking about Paul Levy and the rest of them, we're talking about an actual revolutionary party, not a small political or even a large political organization, but an organization that has the adherence of a substantial layer of the working class and working class militants in your country. And so I think that those aren't easy questions, but I think looking at the Levy affair, as it came to be known, is useful for figuring that out. So one piece of information going into the March action that I think is really important is that both Zetkin and Clara Zetkin and Paul Levy, who I think were two of the sharpest minds in the German Communist Party, resigned from the Zentral, the sort of central committee of the KPD, very shortly before the March action. And I think that, you know, Levy very clearly had an idea that this was coming. They had had conversations with people on the Zentral. They had an idea of the direction that the party was going in. They knew that the leftists were beginning to dominate on the Zentral, and there was a political dispute and debate actually over a related question, but a question having to do with the handling of the party in Italy, and they both resigned their positions. And I would argue, and I'll come back to this, I would argue that this was one of their first mistakes, that they left the field clear, actually, for their political opponents on the Zentral to move forward rather uncontested. And actually, at one point, Lenin writes a letter to Zetkin and Levy and says, to withdraw from the Central Committee, that, in any case, was the biggest mistake. If we tolerate such practices, where responsible members of the Central Committee withdraw from it when they are placed in a minority, the Communist Party will never develop normally or become strong. Instead of withdrawing, it would have been better to discuss the controversial question several times jointly with the Executive Committee. And I think the point Lenin's making here is not an abstract point about discipline, but that the only way to be able to resolve political debate and the only way to be able to move forward and develop a cohesive leadership team is if you're actually able to work those debates through and figure out how to move forward. And I'm not arguing that that would have been an easy thing for Zetkin and Levy at all, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but that sets the stage really for Bela Kun to be able to come in and make these provocations and arguments and really win the upper hand. I think it's a debatable question whether Zetkin and Levy, had they stayed on the Zentral, could they have prevented the March action from taking place? I'm not going to argue that, but certainly they didn't push for that opportunity to do it. And then you come to the question of the pamphlet, and this is the main issue that becomes the whole debate. Is he wrote this pamphlet, he published it in the press, outside of the party, exposing us, et cetera. And I think there's a couple things about this. One, I think, you know, I've talked to people about it, and it becomes posed as a question about, do you have the right to publish a pamphlet outside of the party? Do you have the right to raise a criticism of an action? And to me, that's unquestionable. Of course, like, the question of a right is not really a question. Is it the right thing to do? Was it the right course to take? Seems very questionable to me. The March action came to an end on April 1st. Levy sends his pamphlet to the printers on April 9th. To me, what that says is that he was consumed with spending his time writing this pamphlet, which I agree is quite brilliant, rather than engaging in a series of arguments and debates with the people who actually could have played some kind of a substantial role in pulling things back. It also means that he was very concerned to raise the alarm bells, rightfully so, because of the disastrous course of the March action, but to raise the alarm bells about it rather than try to see himself as playing a role in leading it defensively out to some kind of a conclusion where you could minimize losses. I mean, I would think that in this situation, once it became apparent that the March action was a complete disaster, the argument is not to like go after it and attack the leaders who led it. The first action is to figure out how do I argue for an orderly retreat to preserve as many forces as possible, and then open up a discussion and debate about how that could have gone forward. Instead, the pamphlet comes right out, and I have to agree with, I think it's Lenin who says something about like there's not a comradely feel in the pamphlet. My co-presenters may or may not agree with that, but I read it and it's brilliant, and yet you do get the feel of someone who stands outside of the party and is attacking from the outside. And in fact, at one point, he's responding to critiques that he played into the white terror, that the reaction was on the full-scale offensive at the moment that he published his pamphlet, and that he played into that by publishing in the outside press and gave, you know, aid to the enemy, if you will. And he responds to that by saying essentially that workers pay the price, so leaders should have to pay the price too. And if something I say is then used for people to lose their positions or lose their freedom, et cetera, that's a price that has to be paid. And it's kind of an odd, it struck me as an odd approach for him to take. And so I think the real question is that when we talk about patiently explaining, I think the way Paul went through, like when Lenin talks about you need to patiently explain, that also has to apply to the leftists in one's own party. These, you know, as John laid out, these represented real material forces. There were 50,000 people in the left-wing breakaway to the KPD. You know, in fact, there were numbers of people who had been expelled by Levy himself as he tried to bring the party together to be able to unite with the left wing of the USPD. And so there wasn't that attempt to patiently explain and win over that layer of workers and figure out how to collaborate together. To me, that seems like a major weakness. The question of the Comintern's involvement, I think, is much more complicated than it's often made out to be. Because it's absolutely true that the executive committee of the Comintern sent emissaries, most notably Belakun, to Germany, who played an utterly disastrous, reprehensible, I'm trying to think of those most awful words I can use to describe
bad.
A really, really bad role. I mean, seriously, not just in terms of like what they politically argued, but their methods were just utterly outrageous. Belakun, for example, sends a letter to Lenin saying, I hear you've been talking to Clara Zetkin. The woman is suffering from senile dementia. Mm. She's 65 years old at this point and fighting like a political battle in an incredible way. Suffering from senile dementia, she proves that Paul Lafargue and his wife, Laura Marx, did the right thing. So I look at the footnote.
That's suicide.
The right thing, they committed suicide at the ages of 65 and 69 because they felt irrelevant to the working class movement. Like, this is what he wrote to Lenin about Clara Zetkin in 1921. So we are not talking about, like, you know, good people. we're not talking about people who are operating in an above board way. So that's definitely true. At the same time, it wasn't just the representatives from the executive committee or intervention from Moscow that was feeding this leftist sentiment. It was coming from within the party itself and coming from within the German working class itself. And it was dominant on some of the central leadership bodies of the German KPD itself. And that's clear even, you know, years late, you know, in the following year, that would continue to be true. And so there was a complete dominance of these kinds of ultra-left politics. So you go into the Third Congress of the Comintern in June following the March action, and there's a question about what do we do? You know what I mean? And so Lenin and Trotsky, who are also members of the Comintern, also not from Germany, are actually the most clear-sighted in terms of seeing that there's been a disaster that's taken place in Germany. The theory of the offensive has to be completely dismantled. It has to be argued against. It has to be made completely, it has to be undone politically. They're in a very, very difficult situation. We think of Lenin and Trotsky like, oh, they come in and what they say goes. That wasn't what happened at all. In fact, Trotsky gave a speech at the Third Congress where he ended up viciously attacked for backing Paul Levy's politics, for backing the idea of the United Front, for critiquing the theory of the offensive. And the ultra-lefts were on they were on a complete rampage. Like I said, the attack on Clara Zetkin going into the meeting, they tried to prevent Clara Zetkin from even meeting with Lenin. They had spread a whole number of really vicious personal character assassinations on Paul Levy. And so the question that they faced, that people like Lenin and Trotsky faced, was how do we figure out how to work with the best elements in the party but prevent a split? And to win the most the important political lessons out of it, and to reset the course of the party and of the Comintern as a whole, because these questions didn't just exist in Germany. They existed actually, as one of you said, across Central Europe. And so they went into discussions with Zetkin, they went into discussions with the leadership of the KPD, and they made an incredibly hard argument against the theory of the offensive, and argued some of the clearest political stuff that remains to this day. They talked about how the world capitalist system had been able to temporarily restabilize. We were in a period of defensive struggles. We needed to open up a period of united front struggles. And a lot of those writings, many of us today still look to in terms of talking about united front policy and politics. At the same time, they were in a very difficult position when it came to Paul Levy, because he probably shouldn't have been expelled. On the other hand, there was no way they were going to be able to unite everyone without some kind of a sacrificial offering, was really the way it was looking. And Levy made things more difficult for himself. I mean, that is just the reality. And Lenin talks about how what he did was not just make things more difficult for himself, but the whole discussion became around his tactics rather than around the political debate that took place. And it wasn't a comradely debate. I think that the reason for that, what forced those compromises, which we can look back and say, how could they possibly have allowed this to happen? How could Zinoviev have kept his seat as the chairman of the Comintern? How could Belakun not have ended up in total disgrace? I mean, it's a real question. But then you go and you look at the sort of small meetings that the leadership had, like that the Russian party had with the German leadership party. And as much as like Lenin and Trotsky were ready to compromise and try to come to some kind of way forward, the German lefts were like, they were still baying for blood, literally. They're like, we want a public apology from Levy, we want Zetkin out, we want Zetkin marginalized. They were going, and so there was a tactical question about how do we prevent a split in this moment when we can begin to reorient. And they were forced to make compromises, and I think that there's a couple of things that you can say about that. One is that those compromises did impede the learning process of the party leaderships across the Comintern. Like, I thought what John started with, that someone in 1961 could say, I don't really understand what happened at the Third Congress, but we went from, you know, being on the offensive to suddenly we were doing the open letter and the United Front, I don't quite get it. Like, clearly that learning process was impeded, and what that meant was it was hard for people to figure out how to move forward and develop an independent leadership in the challenges to come. So that was a real issue. At the same time, the reality is they did reorient the party, and they reoriented the entire Comintern, and Levy's prediction that the KPD would fade away to nothing and completely destroy itself and wouldn't be able to recover from the March action was not true. They actually engaged in a whole number of successful United Front struggles in the following year. They rebuilt their membership, they rebuilt leadership, and they actually opened up a whole discussion within the Comintern as a whole around a whole range of questions. They're taken up quite well in the Fourth Congress. And so it was this dual legacy, really, that came out of it. I think the key thing that I took from this whole experience is what was missing in this period was a cadre, meaning a team of people who could work together over a period of time, withstand disagreement, have sharp debates with one another, not personalize things, and figure out how to move forward. And that is definitely the over-intervention of Moscow played a role in impeding that. But without that over-intervention in Moscow, they also might have broken apart into a million pieces. And that's just the reality of the situation that they were dealt with. And so I want to end, I think I'm at my time, by making one, or 2 minutes? Yeah. 1 minute? Okay. I want to end by making one general point, which is this question of how do you build leadership? Because Lenin makes an interesting point about Paul Levy, because when he wrote the pamphlet, people accused him of being a Menshevik and, you know, selling out to the bourgeoisie, et cetera, et cetera. And Lenin actually writes a letter saying, or an article or something, he publishes something, and he says, it's ridiculous to call Levy a Menshevik. Time will tell if he becomes a Menshevik. You may be able to prove that to me. You haven't proven that to me yet. All you've proven is that he lost his head. Lots of people lose their heads under difficult situations. We need to temper a leadership. We need to learn how to bind a leadership together. We need to learn how to agree. And he says this, hold on, let me find it, because I thought it was such a great quote. Hold on. Why can't I find it? Oh, he says, "The training of experienced and influential party leaders is a long and difficult job. And without it, the dictatorship of the proletariat and its, quote, unity of will remain a phrase. In Russia, it took us 15 years to produce a group of leaders, 15 years of fighting Menshevism, 15 years of Tsarist persecution, 15 years which included the years of the First Revolution, a great and mighty revolution." And I think that that was what Lenin was really arguing in his discussions with Clara Zetkin. I wish I could talk more about Clara Zetkin, but with his discussions with Clara Zetkin at the Third Congress, is this has to be our vision. And I think the reality is, because they hadn't had the time to build up that type of a leadership, there were a whole number of things that flowed from that. But I think it would be a mistake to then retroactively assess that the problem was the attempt to build this leadership, the attempt to build this Comintern, that in and of itself somehow invalidates the project as a whole. It's to say that I think we should rededicate ourselves to building that type of leadership and that type of organization before those kinds of pressures that those comrades were facing in the early 1920s.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.